You can open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 3, verse 1a. We'll only be studying just a part of a verse today. Doing something of a survey on the serpent. Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. Now, the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that Yahweh God had made. This morning, we are going to study Satan. And there's a couple reasons for that. That might sound initially blasphemous or backwards. Aren't we supposed to be studying God? Why would we spend time studying Satan? Well, a couple of reasons. One is that in God's own word, he speaks about Satan over 100 times. So apparently he wants us to know something about him. Second, the New Testament includes several commands to believers to resist the devil, to stand firm. Daniel Lito, my eldest son right now, is memorizing Ephesians chapter 6, 10 and following, the armor of God passage, that you can stand firm against the schemes of the devil. This is a command in the Christian life. So if you're going to stand firm against a scheme, you have to know something about the scheme and the schemer. Third, in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 11, Paul writes the following, quote, "So that we would not be outwitted by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his designs." That is, a mature Christian understands something about his enemy. He knows where the battle will be fought, he knows the tactics that will be used, and he's able to repel those advances and attacks and fiery arrows with a working knowledge of Satan and his schemes. That's why the Puritan, Thomas Brooks, wrote a 250-page book entitled Precious Remedies Against Satan's Devices. It's a fascinating work by an eminent Puritan, and he writes the following. I think I've got a slide for it. There you go. Quote, "Christ, the scripture, your own hearts, and Satan's devices are the four prime things that should be first and most studied and searched. If any cast off the study of these, they cannot be safe here nor happy hereafter." So, to that end, this morning we are going to focus our time on studying the serpent. Of course, that's where we find ourselves in Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. It begins, "Now the serpent, the serpent." Moses also wants us to pay special attention to this adversary. You notice in the flow of Genesis, we've been inundated with the glorious overtures of God's immense power in creation. We've been introduced to God's tender care for mankind in his creation of Adam and then of Eve. And then all of a sudden, like a ton of bricks, here's a serpent. Why are we talking about a serpent? Well, obviously, Moses is trying to arrest our attention. He's trying to get us to focus on something new. You know that in the original, there's no chapter or verse divisions. So for Moses, it was, "And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed. Now the serpent was more crafty." So this is meant to be sudden. It's meant to be a kind of shock. Wait, where did this serpent come from? Who is he? And we actually don't get a lot of explanation here in Genesis chapter 3, do we? We just get introduced to the serpent. Apparently he's a talking serpent. And then he's cursed, and we sort of move on. But the rest of Scripture unfolds for us quite a bit of information about this serpent. And if it weren't for this serpent, then really, the rest of the Bible would be quite different, wouldn't it? Maybe even non-existent. I mean, imagine if your Bible ended at Genesis chapter 2, verse 25. Naked and not ashamed. It's essentially a happily ever after, isn't it? But it doesn't. In God's timing and in his plan, he allows this creature called Satan to invade his garden and work his deceitful schemes such that mankind would be plunged into sin and death, and God would bring about redemption through that for his glory. And yet Jesus says in Matthew 18, verse 7, just a fascinating sentence, he says, it is necessary that temptations come. Whenever you see that word necessary, particularly in the New Testament, it's just a little three-letter word in Greek. Whenever you see that word necessary, you should ask, according to whom? Says who? Who says it's necessary that temptations come? Is it Satan? He would certainly like for temptations to come. No, it's God himself. God himself has ordained it necessary. Not that he has caused temptations. God tempts no one, James chapter 1. Not that God delights in temptation or sin. Obviously, he's opposed to it. He condemns it. He judges it. And yet, Jesus says it is necessary that temptations come. And the first temptation came through the tempter, the serpent. The purposes, plans, and glories that divine wisdom has conceived, which necessitate the tempter, may be beyond our grasp, but we are not beyond the tempter's grasp. So we must turn from a fixed gaze at God to this slithering rebel for our time this morning and pray that by so doing, God will give us grace to resist him. So hopefully I've defended to you why it's worth spending a little bit of time talking about Satan. This is a needful exercise, and I hope a helpful one. We're going to look at this in three parts. The serpent first. Who is Satan? Who is Satan? And if you see in the verse, he's named very clearly. Genesis chapter 3, verse 1, now the serpent. It was the 19th century French poet Charles Baudelaire who coined the maxim, the devil's best trick is to persuade you that he does not exist. There are many, even in the church today, who have bought into that trick, who either explicitly or implicitly act like there is no such thing as Satan. But Genesis chapter 3, verse 1 is under no such deception. It begins, now the serpent. And you read that verse and you say, well, Dan, I see the word serpent, nahash, it's the typical Hebrew word for a snake. That doesn't say Satan. Why are you calling that Satan? Why does everyone seem to think Satan is involved when it just says a serpent? Well, that's a good question. There are a number of reasons for that. Number one, the word for serpent is used 31 times in the Old Testament, and 8 of those times it is a reference to this figure, to Satan. A couple of those. One would be Isaiah chapter 27, verse 1, in which, for those of you who are in the Isaiah class, we're marching in that direction, we'll get there. At the end of all things, he says, the serpent, Leviathan, will be destroyed. A reference to Satan. Job chapter 26, verses 12 to 13, the serpent, also called a dragon, the fleeing serpent, the twisting serpent. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, Paul says, the serpent deceived Eve, and we're not ignorant of his designs, and goes on to say, Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So Paul identifies this as Satan. Probably the most clear verse is Revelation chapter 12, verse 9. It says, quote, and the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. The name Satan itself is from Hebrew, Hasatan, the Satan. It means the adversary or the accuser. It's only actually used 3 times in the Old Testament. 3 times. It's used in Job, it's used in Zechariah, and then eventually it gets used by the New Testament authors, obviously a Greek version of that term, 40 times in the New Testament. Satan tempts Jesus, he sifts Peter, he possesses Judas, he convinces Ananias to lie, he leads the Antichrist and his armies against Christ, eventually he's destroyed. There are lots of titles for Satan that we find in the Bible. I'll list a handful of them here. I think I've got a slide for it. Here's a bunch of titles for Satan. He's called the Accuser, the Father of Lies, the Evil One, the Ruler of this World, the Devil, the Tempter, the Prince of Demons, Beelzebul, which is just like a name for a false god, the God of this World, the Prince of the Power of the Air, the Angel of the Bottomless Pit, and then the Hebrew and the Greek, Abaddon or Apollyon. And John tells you both of those just mean the Destroyer. He's noted in a number of these titles as someone in charge of something. Did you notice that? That he has a kind of limited control afforded to him. That he's in charge in some way. Now, what is he? Like, what kind of being are we dealing with here? I'm sure most of you either grew up seeing or have seen in your life depictions of Satan as kind of a guy in red jammies. He's got a fork, a pointy tail. He's got a pitchfork. He's kind of in a hot place, maybe some horns on his head. He's sneering. Maybe he's got like a snidely whiplash kind of mustache. He's twirling and laughing maniacally at people. That's sort of the pop culture version of Satan. Is that what Satan is actually like? Of course not. No. No, Satan, in summary, is just a fallen angel. That's what he is. He's a spiritual being, an angel like the angels that God created. We don't know exactly when God created the angels. It seems to be that it was on the first day of creation, because it says that in Job that they all rejoiced at his creation of the world. But we don't know for sure. But somewhere in the account of creation, God creates the angels, and he creates them good, doesn't he? Everything is good in his creation. Job 1 lists Satan as one of the sons of God, a term for angels who are coming before the Lord. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, calls him a spiritual force. He's a spiritual being. Matthew chapter 25, verse 41, Jesus says, "The eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels." So he is a devil, but he's the arch devil. He's the fallen angel in charge of the other fallen angels. That's the meaning of that possessive there, the devil and his angels. He's the one over all the rest of them. So if God made all of the angels, that means he made Satan, and they were all made good, all made perfect. How do we get to the serpent, who's now a tempter and who's obviously sinning and causing sin? And the answer has to be that Satan fell in some way, that Satan gave himself to sin, that he, even being in the presence of holy God, created fresh evil in his heart that God himself did not create, and fell. And Revelation chapter 12 seems to indicate that he took a third of the angels with him, which we would now understand as being demons. Now, there's lots of speculation about the fall of Satan. Some place it in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. If you're in my Isaiah class, you know, that's not my interpretation of those texts. I don't tend to think that those texts are about Satan and his fall. I think they're about the king of Babylon and the prince of Tyre. But if you don't have that, you can still understand something about the being of Satan. John Milton, in his epic poem Paradise Lost, he suggests that Satan's motive to rebel against God was, and this is an interesting thought, he says, quote, "high disdain from sense of injured merit that with the mightiest raised to contend." And what he's saying there is, it's in the most basic sense envy. That Satan looked at God with all of his glory and said, "I want that. I deserve that." And that certainly fits the profile for the rest of the way that Satan behaves, even in Genesis 3, as we'll look at next week. Genesis chapter 3, where he says, "Don't you want to be like God?" It seems to be his ultimate goal. I want what God has. It's pride at its heart. But the reality is, I don't think we really have that much information from the Bible about the fall of Satan. We know that on day 6, all was very good. And then we know, Genesis chapter 3, verse 1, there's a lying serpent. We don't even know how much time has elapsed between Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. The Bible doesn't tell us. Some have speculated it happened on the very same day. It happened on day 6 of creation. Maybe. It seems unlikely to me, but especially because day 7 is listed as a day of rest. But whatever the case is, there's been some passage of time, and now we have a lying serpent. We have Satan, fallen, working to undermine God's plan. At some point, Satan falls with his hordes of angels, and God doesn't destroy him right away. God could, couldn't he? I mean, if God is all-powerful, it wouldn't be hard for God to just stamp out a snake. He could do that. So obviously God has a purpose. He has a plan in place for this snake. We know that God did not create evil in the cherubic chest of Satan. But beyond that, I don't think we do know. Folks have speculated historically, you know, where does the first sin come from? Where does that come from? If Satan is a perfect being in the presence of God, holy angel, there is no temptation outside of him, how does he create evil in his heart? And I would just answer with John Calvin and Augustine and R.C. Sproul and others. My answer to that question is, I don't know. I don't know. I don't think the Bible tells us. There are things the Bible tells us and things the Bible doesn't tell us, like how do you reconcile three persons and one God? How do you reconcile two natures and one person? How do you reconcile the will of man and the will of God? There are things the Bible doesn't reconcile for us, doesn't explain to us. I think that's one of them. Where does this fresh evil come from in Satan's heart? I don't know. I know that God didn't create it. I know that Satan's responsible for it, but I don't know where it came from, ultimately. Here, in Genesis 3:1, we notice that he takes the form, however, of a snake, a serpent. Some have speculated how it is. We don't know for sure. Shape-shifting or possession of an animal. Certainly Satan can possess creatures. That happens. So maybe that's what's going on here. Probably the most likely option. Why do that, though? I mean, of all the options for Satan, why take the form of a snake? He presumably chose to do that in this moment. Why did he do that? Again, the Bible doesn't tell us explicitly, but we can surmise that because Genesis 1:28 says that Adam and Eve are to have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth, part of Satan's design in tempting Adam and Eve in the form of a snake is to undermine God's created order. That seems to be what he's doing all throughout. He undermines God's created order by going to Eve instead of Adam. He undermines God's created order by becoming an animal who is supposed to be subject to mankind and instead using that to reverse, to have dominion over them through temptation. Adam, honestly, may have just named the snakes. He was doing that in day 2, naming all the creatures. Adam had dominion rightly over all the animals, to include snakes, and yet here now is one who's coming in to undermine everything that they were to do. Satan is a real fallen angel at war with God and mankind. He's not a red guy with a pitchfork. You also appreciate hell is not his kingdom. People think about Satan as the lord of hell. No, hell is a dungeon for Satan. Hell belongs to God. It's where God pours out his wrath on his enemies. So Jesus calls it the eternal fire prepared for Satan and his angels. But it doesn't mean he's in charge of it. No, it's a prison for him. He is the arch rebel and enemy of God and his people. He hates humanity. He uses what the author of Hebrews calls the fear of death to control mankind. And he tempts. So that's who Satan is. Secondly, we need to see, what is Satan like? What is Satan like? We find here in Genesis chapter 3, verse 1, one word giving us a description of this serpent. Now, the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field. More crafty. The word crafty, it could be a positive or a negative term, depending on the context. It just means clever or cunning. Obviously, in this context, it's negative. Derek Kidner, a commentator, calls it, quote, malevolent brilliance. It's a homonym. It sounds the same as the word in chapter 2, verse 25, for naked. Sounds exactly the same as the word for naked. And that's an intentional move. It's saying his craftiness exposes them. In short, Satan knows how to get what he wants. That's what this word means. He's after something, and he's good at getting it. He's crafty. He's clever. He's subtle. He knows how to do it without alerting the senses. He opposes God with his purposes. He wants to undo all that God is and says and does. He wants to oppose the glory of God and ruin his creation, and he's awfully good at it. If he's all that crafty, though, I mean, why fight God? I mean, if you're that clever, wouldn't you think, man, that's a really boneheaded move to try to take on the omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient creator? Haven't you figured this out, Satan? But the reason I think that Satan opposes God, even though he knows God, knows quite a bit about God, and is quite a good theologian in his own right, I think the reason that Satan still opposes God is because of the nature of all sin and the nature of Satan. All sin is at its core, in some sense, deception. It is the believing of a lie. And what does Jesus call Satan? The father of lies. And the reality is, in order for you to start deceiving someone else, you have to first have been deceived yourself. That's the nature of all sin. Even our own sin, but certainly Satan's as well, is that you have to be convinced this is going to be better. This is going to work out. My plan is going to come to fruition. This sin will profit in some way. So Satan himself is deceived. John chapter 8, verse 44, "You are of your father the devil," Jesus says to the Jews. "He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies." He is the arch deceiver who is himself deceived. You wonder how it is that so many false teachers in the world can keep propagating such blatant falsehood. I mean, just think of like the prosperity gospel movement. These guys are getting fat and happy and, you know, fleecing the flock and building massive mansions and saying that they're servants of a lowly, humble Christ, right? Like, how is it that any of this can work together? Well, it's because they've been deceived. Just like Satan, they've been deceived, and therefore they go on to deceive others. That's how Satan himself. So Satan is a deceiver who is himself deceived. Again, Paradise Lost, Milton says that Satan thinks that even though God is turning evil for good, he can still turn that good for evil. He's deceived himself into thinking even though God is going to use him to accomplish his purposes, somehow he can foil it. He says it this way. He says, "And to disturb his inmost counsels from their destined aim." That's what he thinks he can do to God. Whatever God's counsels are, his inmost counsels, he's like, I can mess with that. I can somehow frustrate God's plan, which, again, is a deception. It's a self-deception. You can't foil an omniscient, omnipotent God's plan, but he thinks he can. One of the things you have to appreciate about Satan is, I think part of the modern conception of Satan is that he's almost like God. Like he's everywhere all the time. He knows everything. No, he's not. He's a creature. He's not omnipresent. He's not everywhere. He's not omniscient. He does not know everything. He's a fallen angel. He's limited. He knows he is lost, but he won't admit defeat. All the same, Satan is still an ancient, studied, deceptive warrior against souls. 1 Timothy chapter 3 says there's the snares of the devil. You can fall into a snare, a trap, like a bear trap. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 16 calls them the flaming darts of the evil one. Deuteronomy chapter 32, Matthew 13, 2 Corinthians 11, and 1 Corinthians 10 all teach that Satan and his demons are the spiritual force behind false religions. When you're worshiping an idol, you're worshiping a demon. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 26, Paul says, "And escape from the snare of the devil after being captured by him to do his will." His snares, his temptations, are for the purpose of doing what he wants you to do. He has a will for your life too. He has a plan for you as well. And that's why he sets the traps, so that you'll do them. Revelation chapter 2, verse 9, Satan is behind the persecution of Christians, which the persecutors believe is offering service to God. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, he says, quote, "Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour." Which, by the way, as a side note, this is one of the reasons why I am premillennial in my eschatology, is because I don't understand how it is that Satan is prowling around if right now, as amillennialists argue, he is also chained in a pit. How's he doing both? I don't get that. So that's a side note. Satan's crafty work is bent toward temptation. That's what he does. That's his chief action in the world today, is temptation. Satan has done a lot of different things throughout biblical history. Today, his chief action is temptation. He wants to attack God by tricking his image bearers into denying God and sinning. That's what he does with Eve. That's what he does with Job. That's what he does with David. That's what he does with Ananias. And I think the point of this word and further descriptions of Satan in Scripture is that he's actually really good at doing it. He's quite clever, quite subtle. John Blanchard says the following, quote, "We are opposed by a living, intelligent, resourceful, and cunning enemy who can outlive the oldest Christian, outwork the busiest, outfight the strongest, and outwit the wisest." Satan's power over people, then, is through temptation, which means the battleground on which he fights is your own desires. That's where he fights. That's where the temptation is pointed. Your own fears, your emotions, your desires, your lusts. Matthew chapter 15, verse 19, and James chapter 1, verse 15, both tell us that it's our own desires that give birth to sin. So you can't ultimately blame the devil when you sin. This is part of James's point there. You can't blame God, and you can't really blame Satan ultimately either. You're responsible. Otherwise, why would God send people to hell if it's only Satan's fault, right? You're ultimately responsible for the decisions that you make based on the desires in your heart. However, Satan does want to come along and suggest, to give opportunities. I don't think that Satan puts thoughts in people's minds. I don't think that's how that works. I don't think that Satan, you know, conjures up images and, you know, invades your brain. Obviously, he can possess people. That can happen. We see that particularly in the New Testament in the time of Jesus. But I don't think, especially with respect to Christians, that Satan is going around putting ideas in your head. I think he's, like with Job, arranging events, that he's causing deception outside of you, enabling you to then fall into traps. Thomas Brooks says it this way, "Satan hath only a persuading sleight, not an enforcing might. He may tempt us, but without ourselves he cannot conquer us." One hint in this direction would be the religion of Satanism. April 30th, 1966, a man named Anton LaVey founded what he called the Church of Satan. And it's still alive today. Satanism is still its own kind of cult following. And you actually see it show up more in the news and in Hollywood. He has written a book called The Satanic Bible. I would encourage you to never read it. But he says something really interesting, buried in one of the chapters there, and this is what it is. It's the heart of Satanism. The most simplified description of satanic belief is indulgence instead of abstinence.
Oh dear.
There it is. Satan has just told you what his playbook is. The one religion that's named after him, this is the goal. Do what you want in your sinful heart. Don't say no to yourself. Say yes to all your desires. That's what will satisfy you. And that's Satan's temptation. The Bible is obviously opposed to all forms of satanic influence. And one of the clearest ways that it tells us to oppose it is to be watchful. If you want a clear application of understanding Satan's craftiness, it's, well, then you got to pay attention. Don't fall spiritually asleep. Know that you have an adversary like this who is prowling around, and be on guard against temptation, against the sin in your own heart and the temptations without. We have to be watchful. What did Jesus say to the disciples in the garden? He said, could you not stay awake for just an hour? Be awake. Stand guard. Be watchful. What did Paul say in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13? He who thinks that he stands, let him take heed, lest he fall. Take heed, because we have an adversary who is crafty. Lastly, who is Satan's maker? If that's who this fallen angel is, and that's what he's like, who is his maker? Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that Yahweh God had made. And I'm just sort of extrapolating here. This text doesn't explicitly tell us about God's creation of Satan, but I'm extrapolating from this phrase to say that Satan is a creature. Satan is not, like in Mormonism, Jesus' brother. He is not a rival god to God. He's not just a spiritual force that somehow arose apart from God and his will. No, he's a creature that God himself made. He's not a creator. He's a subject of the God of heaven, and therefore entirely under the control of God. Luther said he is God's devil. Satan only exists and acts at God's pleasure. He doesn't do God's pleasure. That's a distinction to make. But he only exists because God allows him to exist. You remember Job chapter 1 and 2? Satan, with all the other sons of God, is paraded there before God, and it's God himself who initiates the conversation. Have you considered my servant Job? And then Satan's like, oh, I got plans for him. And God says, okay, well, you can do this much and no more. He says the exact same in the next chapter. Luke chapter 22, verse 31. Do you remember Jesus says to Peter, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. He had asked for permission. He didn't just go and tempt Peter. He had to ask Jesus for permission. But Jesus says, man, doesn't Peter just wish he said, so I told him no. That's not what he says. He says, but I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. So Jesus, who is God, allows Satan to exist and allows him to tempt his disciples, and yet preserves his disciples through it. In Genesis chapter 3, verses 14 to 15, we'll get to shortly, God curses Satan. He's in charge of Satan because he curses him. That's obvious. Satan doesn't curse God in that sense. God curses Satan. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 to 15. Can't remember if I have this up here. There you go. That through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. God, in Jesus Christ, destroys the works of the devil. He's more powerful than him. This is the great work of the gospel, that Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil. That Satan brings sin into the world through temptation, and through that sin then comes death. And so Jesus dies and rises again in order to give people eternal life so they don't have to be afraid of death anymore. The design of Satan. But God's design overrules. God has given Satan enough leash to exercise his wicked tyranny on earth, but he is not in charge. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 to 3 calls him the prince of the power of the air. 2 Corinthians 4, 4 calls him the god of this world. 1 John chapter 3, verse 8 says, whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil's been sinning from the beginning. So Satan has some limited dominion over this world through temptation. And in fact, when Christ returns to take his church, Satan's going to have even more power in this world. During the tribulation, he's going to be in charge of the whole world through the Antichrist. But where ultimately does this created being, Satan, find his end? Let me read for you from Revelation chapter 20, verses 7 to 10. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them, and the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. That's his end. So Satan is not in charge, ultimately. And he does not win. But Jesus does. So what are you supposed to do with all this? Three just quick applications for you. One, know that you have an adversary. Don't be deceived into thinking there is no such thing as a spiritual force called Satan. That, well, we're just tempted by our own desires and there's nothing outside of me that's trying to get me to sin. No, you need to know. There are forces in this world ruled by Satan working towards your sin. Working towards your even apostasy if he can get it. Know that you have an adversary too. Don't ignore him. Be watchful. Cling to Christ. Kill sin. One of the ways that Satan's temptation works is that he tries to get believers to despair. That's one of his weapons of temptation, to kind of be self-pitying. I love the hymn, Before the Throne, says, when Satan tempts me to despair, and tells me of the guilt within, upward I look and see him there who made an end to all my sin. That's what you do in the face of the temptation of Satan, is you run to Christ. You don't say, well, I'm stronger than him. That's kind of the charismatic approach to this. You know, I've been clothed with the power of Christ, and so I bind you, Satan, and cast you out. That's not a power that's been given to you. That's a power that Jesus has. He can do that if he wants. That's not a power that you have. You don't get to talk to Satan and tell him what to do. That's a fool's errand. No, you resist him and stand firm by putting on the belt of truth and the breastplate of righteousness and the shoes of the gospel of peace and the helmet of salvation and taking in your hand the shield of faith and the sword of the Spirit and praying at all times. That's what you do. You fight the good fight. You're not in charge of Satan, though. We don't have binding powers. James chapter 4, verse 7, submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Jesus will protect you as you cling to him. And then third, take courage, because your adversary cannot win. His end is eternal torment, and you are held by God who holds his chain. God will not let you be tempted, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, beyond what you can endure, but he will always provide a way of escape. You are held firmly and securely in the hands of God, who will destroy Satan. So you don't need to live in fear of Satan. I remember talking to a gal one time who had come to our church through a friend. She was from Latin America and had been going to a Pentecostal church almost all of her life, and she had a couple kids. And she said, "I have lived almost all of my life under the sovereignty of Satan. Just thinking that he could make me do anything. He could take away everything. He could control me. He's in charge." Because he was so emphasized in that particular context, in her church context. She said, "And then I came to a Bible church and I heard a biblical understanding of Satan. And now I understand I'm living under the sovereignty of God, not the sovereignty of Satan." And oh, what a comfort. All the anxiety just melts away when you realize he's not going to win. He's not ultimately. So what should we take away from this? You have an adversary. Don't ignore your adversary and take courage. The snake may bite, but Christ will crush his head. And one day, here's what's really fascinating, you will too. Romans chapter 16, verse 20, "And the God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet." One day, you will rule with Jesus in his heavenly kingdom, and all spiritual forces of evil will also be subject not just to the eternal reign of Jesus, but to you through Jesus. You will crush Satan under your feet. What a hopeful message that is. That we don't have to fear even the strongest foe of God and mankind, because God has already defeated him at the cross and one day will defeat him fully.